Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully it gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. Welcome back, our tech enthusiasts and digital disruptors. You've turned into the one and only podcast where the bites are bigger, the data deeper, and the tech talk is so cutting edge you might need a software to patch your ears. After a holiday hiatus that saw Jason and I, the dynamic duos of tech, Jason, our CTO, of course, and the Wizard of Wiring, and myself, the Sultan of Statistics, embark on quotes that may or may not have involved trying to automate their holiday lights and applying machine learning to the perfect art of gift giving. We're back, and yes, we missed you. In today's episode, we're going to dive into the tech trends that didn't take a holiday break. We're going to explore what's been brewing in the tech pot while we're sipping on our eggnog and unwrapping our gadgets that, frankly, might just automate us all out of a job. Welcome back, Jason. How are you?
It sounds like somebody got a pro subscription to ChatGPT for Christmas.
Ding, 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 ding. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Yes, that intro was compliments of the ChatGPT 4. You're welcome.
Yeah, although February. And so we took a little bit more than Christmas break. We had Christmas and then CES and then a client roadshow. So it's been a little while, but glad to get back in studio and talk to you.
Yeah, me too. I think it's really good. And I've definitely been excited to dive into the topics. If we can rewind the tape all the way back to holiday break, did you have a good break? It was good. Productive? Anything fun? Did you catch any amazing fish or anything?
I did actually fish a lot over the break and did catch some good fish. So it was fun. It was the kids were in town for the and the grandkids were in town for the all together for the first time in a while, and that made my wife really happy. They all came home, and it made me really happy when they all left and went back to their homes.
Wait, don't they listen to this sometimes?
Yeah, no, they do not.
Okay, we're good then. That's amazing. And then we dove straight into CES, which, by the way, I made a critical life mistake. I took the week off between the new year and that first week of January. And then we dove directly into CES, which means I had really been not working for several weeks and then dive into a conference, which, again, pro tip, don't ever do that. That was a terrible choice. But what did you think of CES? This was the year of AI. I was so excited to attend and learn what cool things I should be doing.
There were a lot of interesting things there and really cool things, but they were somewhat, I would say, incremental, you know, small increments over last year, nothing entirely new. And not that incremental improvement is not bad, but just nothing stood out as going from 0 to 1 instead of 1 to N.
Yeah, I agree. I was really quite disappointed on that front. You know, it felt like, wow, this is mostly just the same stuff we saw last year with some small tweaks. If we dive into that, some examples, you know, we saw IoT everywhere. That's not a new trend, but, you know, it was interesting to see some new use cases. I think my favorite was the fact that the Oura Ring, which I think both of us actually have from some holiday party 3-4 years ago now. Apparently, there's about 5 million competitors to that now that were all launched at CES. Yes. And I was kind of confused because that doesn't seem CES worthy. I'm like, I already have one of these. In fact, the battery is almost worn out. I think I need a new one. Why are you launching these again?
Well, that's why they launched it. Maybe get you to switch over.
That's right. We also saw a lot in the sleep tech space. We saw this last year as well. This year, it was sort of taken to a new level of really, we're now integrating all these bits. So last year, we saw that there was a smart bed that would automatically adjust the angle with the adjustable base. We've seen that, you know, some sort of blanket or mattress pad or whatever would alert you when you were snoring. Same with pillows. This year, we saw all of those systems actually come together in kind of a cool way. That is, they're creating a whole symphony of products. So you have the bed connected to the pillow, which will then adjust. There's the wave pillow, it was called. You would sort of move your head side to side. Maybe that was then connected to like an EEG, which was connected to your air conditioner, which was connected to your car, which was connected to your dot. No, I'm kidding. But it was the idea that we'd sort of take all these gadgets and start actually making decisions to change the environment, not just in one dimension, but on a couple of dimensions.
I thought the two biggest things I saw, one was all the TVs. There were hundreds of TVs that were clear. You could see through them when they were off. Those were really cool, I thought.
That was very CES worthy in my mind.
The battery powered TVs kind of were really Tesla version of a TV, I guess, and were pretty interesting. There was a ton of haptics, right? Like whether, you know, AR, which was really surprising given industries kind of turn away from augmented reality and metaverse, if you will, but all kinds of glasses and goggles and headsets and tons of haptics, you know, gloves and body suits and all of those things. So that was a little surprising to me that there was so much investment in that after really a huge cut in investment in kind of metaverse.
Yeah, I think that it was interesting to me too. I saw some things that made a bit more sense. So for example, taking that technology and applying it to different domains, so not necessarily the metaverse or gaming domain, but we saw one that would effectively help people with Parkinson's and nerve damage sort of control limbs in ways they historically haven't been able to. That was kind of neat. There's a lot in the elderly tech space sort of using the same sort of technology to do enable them to be more mobile. I guess really to me though, that meta point is it comes down to this idea that software is really fast to innovate and hardware is really slow. These startups probably had started their invention right. and manufacturing of these things, you know, 5 years ago when it was really hot. And it frankly just took them that long to get hardware that actually worked at that scale.
Yeah, I think, you know, software eating the world is only speeding up. And a lot of the, you know, we talk a lot about AI recently, you know, AI is just accelerating that software trend. It still takes a long time to build hardware though.
Yeah. Speaking of hardware, one of the coolest things I saw in the IoT hardware space was a baby monitor. You're now staring at me wondering why it's that cool. Well, it was cool because they actually used machine learning to identify the cries of the baby. And so we'd seen, you know, in the previous years where you're taking the video and you're now processing how many breaths per minute, what's the heart rate? You can get all that from video and that's good and that's helpful. But I think it's really cool that you can then identify this cry means they're hungry. This cry means they have a wet diaper. This cry means whatever. And I think that was really a neat thing. How accurate it is hard to say, but it's a really cool idea and a neat application of machine learning. The other bit that I would say is as you think about all of these devices now, so we have these Oura rings, we have these sleep pillows, we have these, you know, pee strips that you can learn about what vitamins your body has or deficiencies you have, all of this stuff, you end up in this world where what I'd call sort of disconnected care. That is to say, you have more information about yourself than ever before. The challenge is it's not where it actually needs to be. Meaning I'm not really sure what to do with it. These systems are not connected. I have to then go across multiple systems to parse it. And even if I could parse and I didn't do the effort to go through all these different apps to get all the data and correlate it, I'm not really able to do anything. If it ultimately has to get to the hands of a physician or some medical professional. And I think this is an ongoing challenge that's only been exacerbated by all these devices around us collecting more information than ever.
I think there's a couple different problems there. One, I agree, you know, it's disconnected. The data's all over the place. There's a lot of privacy security issues, really increases the surface area of attack. And how do you get that data securely to physicians? But a further problem is that even if you got it to the physician, are they really going to trust it and care? Or what are they going to do is tell you to come in and run all those tests to get all those things. Now, maybe it is a good way to get people to go do those tests, which is helpful. You know, a lot of people like me will avoid going to the doctor. I do think, you know, they want to see, and I think that's probably trust of the data, liability, all of those reasons, which are all valid, that, you know, they need some FDA approved device to tell them, well, this is what it is right now. So I don't see that it is going to invade on the actual medical device space. But I do think, you know, to the extent some of them get FDA approved or whatever, maybe, you know, down the line, if we can solve the secure transmission and privacy issues.
Yeah, I think it's good. I would say two things. One, I do think there's a lot of data that could be captured individually that's really difficult for a doctor to capture. So for example, you know, you can imagine these apps now, you can take a photo of what your actual plate, and in theory, you could calculate volumetrics of everything there. So you know exactly how much you ate, and you could use machine learning to figure out what types of food you ate. So was it chicken? Was it pasta? What was it? Those are things that would be hard for a doctor to get information on, but might be really relevant.
Just go to somebody's TikTok feed or Facebook post.
True, yeah. And so I think, you know, there's stuff like that, the sleeping stuff, of course, you know, apnea machines, pillows, beds, all this tells you something about the quality of sleep, which again, you could do in a sleep lab in theory, but ongoing basis, it's not practical. So there might be some confounding variables that maybe perhaps you don't always have some problems, but sometimes you do. And so I think that could be powerful. But I agree, I think the biggest thing will require a reimagination of how medicine is practiced today. How are you going to dump all this data on a doctor? How are they going to parse it? What are they going to do with it? They only have a few minutes per patient, really, to do much of anything. And so we're going to have to figure out how to solve that.
Well, I think also it's more liability than anything, right? Are you making decisions based on some untested, unregulated, unapproved device? No one's going to do that, right? They're going to get you in the, you know, sleep lab and use the FDA approved devices to measure it, make decisions off that. I mean, that's just in their own best interest. Now, you can argue whether that's good or bad, but that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think you're seeing these consumer grade devices get more and more FDA approval. I think they're going after that stuff, if nothing else, then for credibility, saying our device is actually good. It does what it says it does. I agree that there are strong incentives for the medical profession to use their labs, their devices, because they bought them and they want to recoup that money. And that's actually sort of how they make money. That's a profit center for them. So there's strong incentives there, but we'll see, I guess. I think that you will find probably some wave of doctors that end up trying to differentiate their practices by the adoption and leveraging of this massive collection network that people are imposing on themselves and their homes and their cars, on their bodies all the time. I mean, I think that will be a thing that will continue to evolve over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think maybe younger doctors that are, you know, more digitally native, grew up in that environment, are going to be a lot more trusting than older doctors that didn't. And so that's part of it. And I think the regulation, I would hope that that trend goes. I'm somewhat skeptical just because of really what it requires is some change in law and regulation and, you know, what is accepted as best practice. And those things just take a really long time.
Makes sense. The other thing I saw, we've talked about this before, which is that, you know, rising wages are a big thing for at least the U.S., other countries to some degree as well. There are states in the U.S. who are currently changing laws for fast food workers in particular, raising those minimum wages for large chains. And it creates this really difficult economic situation where these restaurants are forced to pay very high wages to get very limited talent. And there was a big opportunity for robots to come in and start automating a lot of the tasks. And we saw a lot of it actually at CES this year. We saw everything from consumer grade stuff, like you can now roast your own coffee beans and then grind them and then brew your coffee. The AI does all of that for you, what temperatures, what roast grade, what roasting characteristics you want. We saw the mix me a bar drink, so the automated bartender. We saw the ice cream version. We saw the smoker. We saw the grill. We saw all of the things. You just dump the meat in, you dump the ingredients in, and it does the rest for you. We also saw some commercial grade stuff, whether it be the food cart. There was one for a cotton candy machine, an ice cream machine, where it actually like makes different patterns and designs, as well as sort of full on commercial kitchen devices that can make noodles or steaks or flip burgers or whatever. I'm curious from your standpoint, like, is this the beginning of that real revolution? I know we've talked about it before and it was a little early, but definitely towards that. Any thoughts based off what you saw?
I think definitely in the fast food space, a lot of that is going to become automated because, again, it's an economic imperative, I would say. I started consulting. I majored in physics and then worked in the lab at GTRI and then went into consulting. In my first job consulting, inflation adjusted, I made less than what I could make working at a Buc-ee's right now.
Yeah.
And you're listening and don't know what a Buc-ee's is.
Gas station with a cult-like following.
Yes, enormous 7-Eleven, size of a warehouse. They're all over Texas. And
I think like really nice truck stop in terms of scale and accommodations, but it's not just for truckers. It's for
cult. A cult-like following, which, you know, they'll pay $50,000, $60,000 a year for people working, you know, in the Buc-ee's, which, again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not passing judgment on that. I'm just saying economically, a fast food place cannot afford to pay 30 people $60,000 a year, right? They just can't do it.
Yeah, at least not with their current pricing.
Exactly. And you have seen, I saw a Wall Street Journal about this. There's been a really big backlash at a lot of fast food places. There was a Wall Street Journal article about McDonald's and, you know, someone, they got like the number one combo, the Big Mac fries. It was like $19 or $20 in New York just because of all the added costs, right, you know, that you get in those markets. And so it is, you're going to either have to adjust the prices or automate.
Those types of restaurants often are the main source of a lot of food for people who otherwise don't have too many options. And so it's especially difficult policy-wise what you do there. I guess if you sort of fast forward the tape, call it 10, 15 years, and this, let's assume that this trend continues. So if you sort of fast forward, call it 10, 20 years, and assume that this trend of consumer-grade devices continues, that is, we see coffee machines, and we see ice cream makers and we see full-on kitchens that are automated in the home, is there still the need for this restaurant scene, or does that change fundamentally because you end up having, you know, sort of a Star Trek replicator in your own house? And maybe that's easier, more convenient, and cheaper than going to a restaurant. I'm sure the restaurants will exist. They'll bifurcate in some meaningful way. I'm just curious if you had any initial thoughts on...
Well, I don't know that people go to, you know, fast food because always because it's...
Convenient?
Yeah, easier, cheaper. You know, it's more of, you know...
I mean, I can tell you I got a lot of Chick-fil-A.
It's more like, hey, yeah, I know. You've got young kids still at home. I mean, they want to go to Chick-fil-A. Right. And it's not because it's easier or more convenient for you or faster or anything else. You know, I think there's still always going to be the fact that people are not going to be in their homes. You know, where I am at 4:30 every Friday, Saturday, Sunday morning on the road to fish. And so, you know, there's limited options in East Texas at 4:30 in the morning, right, to get some coffee and breakfast. So, you know, maybe you make it, but they'll always exist. But I do see them becoming much more, you know, kind of automated. I think the ghost kitchen idea is going to continue to accelerate, you know, because I think delivery, if we've seen anything past COVID, it's been that, you know, delivery is that acceleration happened during COVID. I think it was somewhat of a forcing function for a lot of places that didn't do delivery to have to figure it out. Now that it's there, that's what last night, Leslie didn't feel like going out. She wanted Mexican food from her favorite Mexican restaurant and someone, you know, will deliver it. And so that is going to continue. Interesting thing to me will be around, will there be consolidation in all of these, you know, the hundreds of delivery providers into a few? I think likely there will be for cost, but I think from that kind of ghost kitchen perspective, that just makes sense for a lot of these, for economies of scale.
Makes sense. I want to pin a pin in that delivery. I want to come back to that here. But one last thing I wanted to mention, which was really, as I said, CES was advertised, purported to be the year of AI, generative AI specifically. You can even go to their actual logo. I mean, that thing was clearly generated by some Gen AI kind of looking. It was a woman with headphones on, some like futuristic background, but very Gen AI looking. I mean, I don't know if it was for sure, but it definitely looked like it was created by something like that. I was pretty disappointed with what I saw, though. I really did not see anything meaningful in this space. I think
in the Gen AI space.
In the Gen AI space specifically, that's right. Yeah, you saw VW sort of announce they have this new Gen AI in their car, this agent, which I guess instead of saying navigate to a place, you can ask it in more natural language to navigate to a place. I guess that's good. It could sort of tell you what your calendar is in words. And yeah, I don't know. It didn't feel like that was that exciting.
CarPlay does that today, but.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't seem that exciting to me. Again, it's the first. I get it. So they're going to continue to work on it, no doubt. And probably come up with something interesting there. You saw some stuff on like a bicycle. This was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. Basically, it was a bicycle that you could talk to. It had some sort of cellular connection to ChatGPT and you could do whatever. I'll just tell you, having worked in heavy industrial, noisy environments, that anything voice does not work in the real world unless it's right next to your face. So that's a terrible plan because you're going to hear honking and cars and people screaming and it's never going to understand what you're saying, but whatever. The biggest sort of noisiest thing was the Rabbit R1. This was a sort of next-gen device conceptually that is really designed around the idea of a natural language interface as a very small screen. It has a camera, you could talk to it, and it can do all of the things that, you know, you'd want it to do in theory. But I don't know, overall, I was incredibly underwhelmed. Yeah. There were really no novel use cases that I saw at all. They were the things we've been talking about for 8+ months, and it was the very first version of those, and it was just very disappointing.
And we did see everything, if anyone is wondering, and I have the swollen knee to prove it. Like if someone could, if Gen AI could generate me a new left knee, that would be great. I was like, I'm barely able to walk at the end of that thing. Plus, Vincent's like two feet taller than me, and so he'd be like, oh, I walked 6,000 steps today, and I look at my watch, I walked 30,000 steps, and we like, wait, that can't be right. Does Vincent really take, you know, one step to four for me? And so we like on the bridge to the Bellagio, we measured it out. And yes, the answer is yes. It takes me 4 steps to catch up to every one step of Vincent's.
Yeah, I don't know what the correct form is, but we definitely have different forms of walking, it would seem, and different lengths of appendages as a result.
Don't get upset, all right, about what I'm about to say. I do think I'm gonna tie it a little bit to the blockchain, right? In that,
I'm very upset.
Yeah, I know you are. I know you are. In that, you know, the blockchain came around, blockchain and Bitcoin, and you know, it was a little. It's a, and we've talked a lot on this podcast about that, around a solution looking for a problem. It's a really expensive, really difficult to understand, paradigm shifting way of doing things. Is there really a problem that it's good at solving that traditional technologies are not good at solving faster, cheaper, better? And our answer to that has been not very many, right? There may be some, but not very many. And so, you know, there's limited adoption of it. And, you know, rightly so. These things are tools that solve business problems. I think AI is in that space. Not that there aren't problems that AI and generative AI specifically will solve. I think there are a lot. So I think it's very different in that respect, that there are going to be really every problem will be somewhat impacted by Gen AI, and those, you know, people will adopt it to do those. But it is still right now in a technology-led state where we're saying, okay, here's a really cool technology and look at all these crazy things it can do. Like, okay, how do we use that to go solve problems? Now, again, the difference is it actually, I think, is useful in solving a lot of those real-world problems that traditional technologies cannot solve at all, much less, you know, faster and cheaper. So I think that's why you didn't see a lot of things, is that those things are still being figured out. I think they will be figured out, and it will be a very impacting technology, unlike blockchain. I think it's kind of on the same path. It just has a different trajectory on the back end.
That makes sense. And I think it is, you know, this iPhone moment when we now have the iPhone and has a few apps, you know, email and calendar and your phone, and that's pretty cool, but it really kind of misses the point of the iPhone. I mean, it doesn't have a camera. It doesn't have selfie. All of social media is a result of the iPhone. Store. Exactly. The App Store ultimately had to be created before any of that was really realized. And so we're still in that very early stage. There's not really an App Store. I mean, in fairness, OpenAI did release something of an App Store on ChatGPT now, so you can have these little agents. Anybody can go write them and deploy them and see some kind of cool benefit in theory.
Some of those GPTs are really cool on OpenAI or on ChatGPT, by the way. You know, I write a lot of six pagers here around like what are new things that either Credera should do in our consulting business or our clients should do. There's a one called Six Pager Samurai.
No way.
Yeah.
I'm going to check that out later today. That's great.
I'm not saying that I use that.
No, of course not. You were pure R&D, experimental exactly, research. This is for understanding, yeah.
You are like, how did you crank so many of those out last week?
Seriously, like 52 of these things pop on my desk. I'm like, what the heck? This guy is bored. No, I think my favorite, by the way, over the holiday break for that was Salary Negotiator. Not because it helps me actually get a higher salary. I'm not getting any kind of raise here, I'll just be honest with you. But because it made me feel good. I felt vindicated. The little agents on the other side said, like, you know, you're raising some really good points. I'm going to go talk to HR and I'll get back to you about what we can do in this space. And so that made me feel good, and if nothing else. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to come back to this idea of these sort of delivery service. We had a little bit of a heated discussion the other day that was just a hallway conversation. And sadly, we don't...
car conversation on the way down to Austin.
Yeah. That's right. And car conversation. We're going to our offsite.
I want you to set it up because I don't want to straw man your argument.
Well, so we were talking about this idea in the current world. If you are a large, let's just choose delivery. Let's stick with that one. Let's say you're a large QSR. You're like a McDonald's or a Burger King or whatever you are. You have the idea, hey, what we should really do is figure out how to integrate Uber Eats and DoorDash and whatever other ones might be, you know, relative to your geo, like Seamless, for example. There's a litany of these things. The question is, how should you go about doing that? There are really two ways that I see. One is to say, well, look, we're a really big player in the market. We're going to drive a lot of volume for these players. Therefore, what we should do is create, sort of take the traditional software approach. Like, we're going to create a set of APIs and let developers develop on these APIs. In other words, we're going to say, in this case, hey, Uber, Lyft, all of DoorDash, all these services, we've created a standard set of APIs that now you can go build your app to integrate with and everybody will be happy. That's option one. Option two is to say, well, actually, I'm just going to go integrate with each of these apps independently myself as the restaurant, and that'll make everybody happy as well because I can now do this. Great. Of course, if you're the restaurant, option one sounds significantly better than option two. And I would say I agree. Except, and here's the complication. Today, imagine a world where generative AI can write the code for you. What if it can reconcile all of these APIs, understand all of those languages, And you could just do it yourself for really no incremental cost or very low incremental cost, certainly much, much, much lower than it would have cost you a year ago. In that case, I would assert that perhaps actually option two is significantly better because it's faster. You own them. You own all the code, which means you can build it as quickly as you want because generative AI is doing it. It'll go very quickly. And you can maintain it cheaply because, again, as those providers, those delivery services change their APIs, you can just rewrite it. Generative AI will deal with it. And so that was sort of the genesis of the conversation. I'm squarely on side two. I think you're squarely on option one, but I'll let you then justify why option one sounds better.
The overall meta point is, does like really good architecture still matter, right? Correct. Or
good architecture always matters. That's sort of a tautology in my mind. Like, that's true. Good is good. Got it. But the question is, like, does what good architecture is change in light of generative AI? Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
My argument is no. Like, we've spent a lot of, you know, decades really understanding these principles. You know, I don't think that generative AI really changes that. And to use that example, yes, all of that is true. You can do it really fast and you end up owning all the code and in a lot of ways now are on the hook for maintaining that. And every time, you know, let's say we end up Subway or Taco Bell, these are global companies that have dozens of providers, you know, 50, 60 of those in different, you know, countries or different languages with different interactions and pound those out one a week with these generative AI tools and inside of a year support all of them. Yeah, except they're all going to change next year. They're all going to change the year after that. They're like, okay, well, maybe it only still, you know, takes me one, you know, person or one or two people to keep up with all that change, but I still have to do it, right? As opposed to, you know, leaving that for others. And I think there is some benefit, you know, you'd see this in the airline industry, right? A lot where the, you know, original reservation providers, right? They set the standards. And so, you know, standards for bag interchange and ticket interchange and all of those things, being the owners of said standards has a benefit, right? In terms of data, in terms of, you know, everyone coming, you know, you have all the data, people come to you for the data because you know what products sell. And again, I know your argument would be like, look, there's going to be a different product menu and catalog in every one of these different delivery providers in that example. And you're like, well, okay, so the AI can figure and map those things all together and figure out what things sell. But again, why do you want to do that, right? Like, why do that? Why don't you have all that data and you become the provider of insight and those type of things. So I do think there's benefit to it. We've seen that in the airline industry. We've seen that in other industries where the players that essentially become the foundation of the ecosystem have a distinct advantage. And I know you're saying, well, you could do that without, I do think these meta enterprise architecture patterns really do matter. And we want to stick with them, use AI to accelerate getting to that as opposed to using AI to accelerate building technical debt, if we can use that phrase.
Yeah, I hear you. It makes sense. I guess the part that I'm really pushing on is with any technological change, there become certain inevitabilities. And of the mindset, and this is not fait accompli to be clear, but I do think it's directionally headed that way. And I do think it is inevitable. I'm pretty sure, 98% sure it's inevitable, that integrations will become a thing of the past. I'm not saying that you don't have to still understand and standardize and integrate your data, harmonize it, make sense of it. I agree. That's where the value of data comes in. My question is, do humans actually have to do that anymore? Or can the AI just work it out on its own? Can you really just point it at the raw data and say, hey, make sense of this, do something useful with this, and it can work those things out? It's that sort of paradigm shift that I'm most interested in. And again, I'm not certain that it will happen. But if it does happen, then I think that the fundamental underlying sets of principles by which we build architecture today will look radically different.
And here's another example, right? Which is like the spreadsheet. A long time ago, you won't remember this, but you had, if you wanted a report on something or some formatted tabular data on something, like that meant some developers, right, building some COBOL on the mainframe and getting data into the mainframe and formatting it and running jobs and producing reports that then, you know, you could pull up on the green screen or get printed out on green bar paper, which is you know, what we used to do.
Don't know what that is.
Yeah. And people, okay, well, we got the spreadsheet and, you know, spreadsheet came along. Now there's millions of spreadsheets running around, to your point, right? But do we think that that's a good thing or a bad thing? Like we spend most of our time, even though now, you know, and I'm using the spreadsheet as an analogy of lots of people let 1,000 flowers bloom with Gen AI. You know, we spend most of our time, who knows what someone did over here and over here and over here. It's more of a distribution problem. Like, what do? Well, we got to get all that data in one place and figure it out. And what we've done because of that, it was, you know, Salesforce came along like, hey, let's stop generating all these spreadsheets of customers to call and like, let's build an application that is architected well and you can extend for CRM and all of these other things. And so I actually think we've seen this. And, you know, if you go to a non-data IT space, like the principles of building bridges, you know, haven't changed in 5,000 years. Although we've seen incredible technology improvement, not much changes in the fundamental, like what is good architecture from a building or a bridge. I think that will be the case with data as well. Again, I may be wrong and it may be.
I think that's reasonable. I would say that the fundamental, you need a paradigm shift in building material. So the physics will remain the same, no doubt. But if you had a material that was infinitely light, infinitely strong with infinite tensile strength, I suspect you'd see very different architectures being designed and built.
But you don't.
I would argue
the equivalent of infinitely strong and infinitely light.
No, I wouldn't say it is at all, but it is something radically different than we have today. Right. And so, you know, my point would be like, you're right. If you take the spreadsheet example, look, even early days when I was programming, everything was very finicky for CSVs. When you're importing data from one file to another file, you could export it as a CSV. Was it exactly a comma separated? Was it tab delimited? Was it a special character? Like that was all very finicky. Today, you could open up almost anything separated by almost anything and Excel will just kind of figure it out. I think that's the sort of evolution that I'm imagining is like, what if it's not just it can figure out there's a tab here or there's a space here, or two spaces or a comma or whatever it is. It can just kind of look at it and be like, oh, this is the structure. This is the meaning. This is how I'm going to orient it in a way that, you know, CSVs and tab separated files could do that today in Excel.
Yeah. But another example might be of what I'm, the kind of point I'm trying to make is you mentioned earlier, which is the app store, right? Like,
sure.
Okay. So say there's no app store, right? And say it, you know, okay, we've got an AI tools. There's a phone platform comes around. Anybody can generate any app almost instantly. And it becomes a many-to-many app producers to phone. You know, does the platform still take off like it did and become as valuable as? I don't think that it does because there is value in that. Like, okay, we're going to central. You get all of this stuff. We centralize payment. That there's economies of scale, costs that'll be saved. You know, like, look, we're going to make sure that UI standards are met. You know, those are all the things that the app store does, and that you know that things that don't meet the, you know, when we upgrade and the APIs change and your phone, your thing breaks, the app or runs the battery down, we can pull it off. And so a little bit of this is an argument for some level of centralization versus decentralization, right? And I think some of that is good. And that decision around what needs to be centralized and decentralized or what some of those architecture best practices are that we need to, I think, continue to adhere to versus allowing just everything to become a free-for-all because although, yes, and I understand your point, which is it's valid and it may actually turn out this way, economics and all of that change, right? So there you don't have to worry about economies of scale when you can develop things for essentially zero. But I do think there's other benefits to it just besides pure economics. Single sign-on, right, is a good example.
I agree that I think that there could still be some places where it's centralized. There's still benefit to that. But I think it just becomes increasingly less beneficial because, yeah, the costs go to zero. So you're effectively giving everybody economies of scale. You're giving them the tools to disrupt the incumbent players. So again, imagine that the airline example, part of the value of that is that all of the big players subscribe to IATA standards or whatever, you know, whatever standards they have. And so a new upstart is effectively forced to. They want to play the game. They have to play the same as everybody else is playing. But imagine a world where the AI doesn't care. You just pass it whatever information you want in whatever format, and it can figure out what all of those characteristics are. I don't know. It gives people the opportunity to truly disrupt the incumbents in the industry. And I think those are the moments that are really fascinating and fun to think about at a high level. Again, I don't know where this will land. I don't know how good it will end up being. Early signs give me pause. I think that, you know, one of our favorite, we talk about this one a lot, they've been on the podcast too, actually, SnapLogic. They're an ETL tool. Effectively, with their Snap GPTs, they have natural language grabbing data, parsing the data, building pipelines to move the data around with just these models in their infancy. Now, fast forward the tape 2, 3, 5 years. I suspect that's not asymptotically approaching some asymptote in the near term. I think that probably gets significantly better before it sort of tapers off. But I could be wrong. And that'll be that'll be the main question. If it really is to the point that these systems ultimately do understand the underlying data very well and they keep getting better, I do think it's inevitable that integration will be a thing of the past because AI will just do it. And then don't forget the other fascinating bit of that, and we've talked about this before, is that if AI is doing all the integrations, then really what it's talking to is another AI on the other side. And that then might actually shift the way we think about how to even do integration, because it's AI talking to an AI system. They might reinvent conceptually that entire data sharing passing interface, if you will.
Yeah. Look, I agree. You know, with a tool like SnapLogic, for example, you can build integrations really fast or even have the AIs build the integration. But what I'm thinking about is like what's the difference between, we work with them a lot and we like their platform. The reason I do that has nothing, I like it, you know, has nothing to do with all of that AI and sure. how easy it is to generate things versus like a Fivetran, right? Sure. The difference is an architectural distinction to me. Like one sits in your environment behind your firewall, mm-hmm. allows system A to talk to system B. The other is a SaaS product, which requires you to open up those things to the internet, you know, punch holes to each thing and pulls the data out, puts the data back in. So the first to me has just it's a much cleaner solution, a much more secure solution, you know, although both use the AI to effectively drive the cost of any new one down to zero, there are still choices that get made, have impacts. And those are the choices, you know, I'm talking about, I think still matter.
All right.
Now, your point would be like, yeah, but an AI can put two AIs on each side and they can figure it out. But, you know, my point is like putting two on each side is different than putting one in the middle. And those are the kind of decisions I'm talking about when I say architecture still matters.
I think this has been fun. It's good to catch up with you, Jason. This is,
we got to get back and
let's make this a regular thing.
Back and doing this every week again instead of traveling around the world.
Unless that travel destination involves something tropical. I think we'll get back on this here. And so just like that, we're at the end of another electrifying episode where we ventured through the digital jungle of CES.
Oh, no. You're going back to it. Did you have something to summarize this while I was...
Yeah, of course.
...making a very serious point about architecture?
Obviously. We had to dodge the data deluge, marveling the IoT landscapes that's growing faster than blockchain in a bull market. Today, we've seen that IoT gadgets are propping up like notifications in group chat. And the real question lies at making this avalanche of data connect in meaningful ways. It's like having all the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, but no picture on the box to guide us. We observed that innovation seems to be taking baby steps rather than giant leaps, more of an evolutionary nudge than a revolutionary jump. But remember, even the smallest code changes can lead to the next big breakthrough. It's these incremental innovations that lay the groundwork for the next big thing that'll make us say, why didn't I think of that?
Did you use the GPT that tries to maximize adjectives?
I told it to be good and funny and to evoke emotion, and I think that requires a lot of adjectives. Well, anyway, thank you, Jason. I do appreciate it. For those who would like to learn more, feel free to visit the insights page at cordera.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again. Bye-bye.